welcome so much to CCU tonight at Citizens Climate University, and we're trying a new thing. We're actually going to have extended conversations with our speakers every month if they are willing to come back on for an hour of additional conversation. And tonight we have our very own Dr. Marks, who's speaking on the psychology of climate change communication. Dr. Marks is a social scientist based in New York City. Among other projects, she currently serves as project director of risk communication at the National Center for Disaster Preparedness, and her expertise falls broadly within the area of decision making under uncertainty, with a focus on risk perceptions and behavior change. For the past 15 years, she's held appointments at Columbia University's Earth Institute, including the director of research at the National Center for Disaster Preparedness, and a postdoctoral research scholar at the International Research Institute for Climate and Society. She comes by way of Carnegie Mellon, where her doctorate was in medical history, and holds a master's degree from the University of Cologne in Germany. We are so honored to have you on the line tonight, and thank you for being here, Dr. Marks.
We hope that you, after this meeting, will be able to better understand some of the psychological barriers to information processing, that you will have an enhanced awareness of communication challenges, that you will be able to evaluate your current communication patterns, and that you have greater competency and also confidence to connect and communicate with the audiences that you're talking to. First off, we'll go into a little background and review of the national call from January 13th. Then we'll follow up with the answering some of the questions that came in after the call, and one related to climate change skepticism, how to deal with that. How can we learn more about our audience's values, worldviews, and identities to link up with them better? How to get to know your audience better, and I'll introduce participatory processes as a method. Then we go into a little more detail about losses and how we can tap into people's loss avoidance. And then hopefully we'll have time for some Q&A and a back and forth conversation. So let me start with a quick recap of what we covered on the 13th to provide context for those who may not have been able to listen in on that call. So the topics we covered were that risk perception is subjective, we covered some selected barriers to information processing and decision making, and then we ended with some selected communication principles. And I'll just share those in brief in form of key takeaways from that national call. So we see this all the time. Information is not used as it was intended, and that is because people's risk perception is subjective. Decision makers or information seekers are very selective when attending to information because they may not perceive the same risks as you, or they may not perceive climate change as a risk that matters to them. When they do seek information, they evaluate the options using both cognitive and affective processes. And one thing I highlighted there was like the importance of emotional appeals. Decision makers are also influenced by their beliefs, values, goals, and prior experience. And we have also learned in a lot of research that people can benefit from the social context of decision making. A big barrier is to good decision making is like that people lack awareness or access to solutions. One of the key takeaways from last call was like when it comes to appealing to the emotions, like an emotional appeal to take action, because emotions are a wellspring for action and behavior change. I've pointed out that losses loom larger than gains. So tapping into loss aversion, people want to avoid losses. That is something we can do in communication. We can frame something, the same information, either as a loss from inaction or a gain from taking action. And it's still the same information, but framed in different ways. Another phenomenon that I talked about on the 13th was that we have a finite pool of worry. And that means literally, we can only worry about so many things at any given time. And therefore, it is important when we talk about climate change that we link it with some of the priorities that our audience might have that is not climate change. And we can very easily link climate change to national security, to terrorism, and to other issues. Another phenomenon to be aware of is the so-called single action bias. And that is something we find very often when people are taking actions to protect themselves from risk. They will take one action, and their sense of vulnerability and their sense of being at risk and being threatened is alleviated, and they are not engaging in additional activities that would be necessary to solve the very complex problem that we're dealing with in the context of climate change. I also shared some selected communication principles that help overcome some of these communication barriers, and they all relate to know your audience. So is your message relatable? Can you tie in your the information that you're presenting into the most pressing priorities of your audience? Is your message attention grabbing? It gets to like striking this balance of being vivid enough, but not too alarmist. And that's where the emotional appeal, like is the information, does it elicit sufficient level of effective response to generate this desire to take some action? Does your attention motivate action? Does your message motivate action? A really important step here is leading with solutions, and that's something that CCL does very well. But then also, can you translate these solutions into actionable steps that are appropriate for your audience? Breaking it down in batches. And with that, emphasize the impact of taking action, the efficacy, the agency that people have in this apparently overwhelming problem. Does your information foster cooperation, collaboration, and community building, which are all very important in the context of climate change? And here, you can tap into this sense of group affiliation. What do you have in common with your audience, and highlight that? And one way that CCL does that actually is by offering an appreciation when they go into, for instance, the Congressional Education Day, have someone from the same district of the senator or representative that the group is meeting with. So tapping into this common sense of group affiliation, what do we have in common? Now, with this majorly quick recap, we are now able to talk about address some of the questions that came in from the audience. And one of them was like, how do we deal with climate change skepticism in our audience? One of my responses to that is usually like, we want to identify what type of climate change skepticism are we dealing with actually. And there's like probably like three types. One is a skepticism that is part of the scientific process. For instance, this allows scientists to talk about uncertainties that exist in models or in general, like the scientific process. Then there is skepticism that's based on misinformation as a result of groups who have worked to instill doubt and denial among high-level decision makers and the general public, which is quite different from this first form of skepticism. And then there's skepticism that's due to this unconscious underlying psychological process, such as motivated reasoning. And it is really interesting. We perform like mental acrobatics to avoid negative feelings. These three are very different. So identifying what kind of skepticism are we dealing with? Are we looking at just like plain people not understanding the uncertainties in the modeling, the exact timing of adverse events? Is it something like they don't want to deal with the issue and therefore they are skeptical of the information? Or is it that second one that is kind of like this misinformation that is spread to spread denial and doubt? So which one can we address? And I think our effort is best spent on that first and the third forms of skepticism. The second one, where we're dealing with hardcore denial, is extremely difficult to deal with and very often frustrating. And actually, it is a really small, albeit very vocal segment of society, but it's only 10% or so of the population who fall into this category. And Tony Lazarowitz has done quite a bit of work on that. So we may be wasting valuable time if we focus on that hardcore denial group. Now, looking at strategies for communicating uncertainty, it is important to do address uncertainties and early on in the conversation. So pick just a few key facts about climate change from trusted sources to share and put those facts in context. But it is really important to translate unfamiliar or unintuitive statistics into numbers, into relatable terms. And the two illustrations on the side do that very well. So another way of like we can translate numerical probabilities into verbal labels, which the IPCC has also adopted. And whenever possible, provide clear visualizations that show what is known and what is less known, and make it relatable. So everybody knows like the size of a one family, a single family home, like, you know, and what is, nobody knows what a metric ton of carbon dioxide is or the, or emission equivalents. So translating it into something that is visual and that makes it a little more relatable and a little more personable. An equally oftentimes anxiety-inducing challenge for many communicators is how to approach communication of climate science uncertainties where they do exist. So acknowledging them upfront is relevant for understanding and addressing the problems, such as the timing of future climate-related events. So being proactive about discussing uncertainty and differences in opinion that may be in the room, especially in the beginning of your communication, has the benefit of building trust with your audience. It also provides openings to talk about concepts such as the precautionary principle and the opportunity to make common sense, proactive decisions on climate change rather than waiting to see how bad things get before taking action. It's always important to highlight opportunities that uncertainty presents to shape the future. You can help your audience imagine an alternative and a better future. It's not all doom and gloom. So that's what uncertainty does too. It goes both ways. We want to remind people that they make decisions under uncertainty all the time. For instance, enrolling in college. How do you know that your investment will pay off? Investing in stocks, medical treatments, getting married. A lot of decision-making under uncertainty. We don't know the outcomes in advance, but we are used to doing it. So that can take the fear of this decision-making under uncertainty away if we remind people that they actually do it all the time. One point about the precautionary principle, this better safe than sorry. I have a quote which I didn't put on the slides, but it's by Nicholas Stern from the Stern Review. He said, just as people spend a small slice of their incomes on buying insurance on the off chance that their house might burn down, and nations use a slice of taxpayers' money to pay for standing armies just in case a rival power might try to invade them, so the world should invest in small proportion of its resources in trying to avert the risk of boiling the planet. The costs are not huge, the dangers are. So this is like an example of like this like precautionary principle. And we do this, like I think insurance is a really good example of that. So given the current state of public opinion and engagement around the issue of climate change, we know that communicators are likely to encounter skepticism among a subset of audience members. And it is critical that they be that we are prepared. So I really appreciate the question that came from the audience. Part of that means understanding the source and type of skepticism, as I mentioned in the slide with the three types of skepticism that we deal with. And keeping in mind, too, that trying to counter skepticism with a barrage, which this illustration shows, with a barrage of facts can often and does backfire, either because it reinforces some of the myths people have heard before, or simply because it leads people to shut down and just stop listening to you altogether. So there it is important to focus on the when and not the if. When are we, what are we doing when the next flooding occurs? What are we doing when the next heat wave occurs? And not, well, if we have a heat wave, we would be doing this. Then focus on solutions, not just the problems. Lead with the core concept you want people to grasp and use only a few of the most important facts to support it. Again, like, don't bombard people with a barrage. It doesn't necessarily give you more credit or more trust. It leads very often to shutdown. Focusing on just a few important facts can help counter myths and support a deeper engagement. So to sum up the strategies for dealing with a skeptical audience, engaging skeptical audiences effectively involves understanding where your audience is coming from, focusing more on solutions than the problems, and finding that common ground to build on. And that common ground, actually, in the next segments, I'll be talking about finding common ground in shared values, shared worldviews, or identities in like a shared group identity. Again, knowing your audience will make you a better communicator. And one of the most important first steps is to understand, or one of the many steps you can take is looking at what values, worldviews do your audience members hold? What do they identify with? And these can then drive your communication strategy, including what to say, how to say it, and very often also who to say it. Like, who should your messenger be? It may not be you who is most aligned with the values of this group, or you may not be seen as the best messengers. Values, worldviews, and identities are very important in helping people make judgments about climate change, and they do shape their engagement. The overarching idea is that things that make up people. How do you describe yourself? How do you relate to the world in a meaningful way? How do you engage with others? Values, worldviews, and identities, we separate them artificially to study them, to be able to study them, and there's a lot of overlap. But values are things like, do you value independence, privacy, equality? Worldviews would be more like looking at do you have a hierarchical worldview or an egalitarian worldview? And identities describe things such as are you a mother? Are you a Republican? Are you a business person? You could be all three of these actually in one person. So the important thing is that we will try to align our messages with the values, worldviews, and identities of our audience. A little more detail on values. Here are a few more examples of values: honesty, hard work, loyalty, privacy, equality, patriotism, fairness, independence. Those are things that people are guided by across some of the domains that they work in, like at home, at work, at church. And they are kind of like guiding principles in their work. So if a message about climate change aligns with someone's values, they're likely to support it. If a message about climate change clashes with someone's values, however, the messages probably won't work. And here's an example of a misalignment. So someone who strongly values personal property rights, when they hear that dunes are planned to be built to protect the coast against sea level rise and that they will obstruct their waterfront view, this person is likely to A, not support the dunes, and B, also dismiss or deny one of the primary factors that would justify these dunes, namely sea level rise that's being exacerbated by climate change. An example of alignment would be for someone who values independence and self-reliance, you might emphasize the fact that solar power, for instance, can help to decentralize the grid. That's a message frame that's being used, for instance, in Georgia by a Tea Party group called the Green Tea Coalition. So that's like a really interesting thing, how we can actually get like people from a group who you wouldn't expect to be on board with green energy and environmentalism, but by framing the issue as independence and self-reliance, they are actually on board. A few more examples of how we can align climate change with existing values. Someone who values national security may be receptive to hearing about how renewable energy can reduce dependence on foreign energy sources, thus improving national security. Someone who values prosperity might be motivated by messages that emphasize how clean energy solutions can unlock new economic opportunities for American families. Strengthening community preparedness for future natural disasters may speak well to people who strongly value hard work and self-sufficiency. And lastly, what all of them have in common is like the elements of a response to climate change. Many elements align with American world, and this should say values, align with American values, and climate change solutions go hand in hand with existing values and their respective goals. And related to the first example here of national security, I want to just read to you a quote by Senator John McCain of Arizona. It says, our nation has both an obligation and a self-interest in facing head-on the serious environmental, economic, and national security threats posed by climate change. So that is like a clear alignment of Republican values with a climate change agenda. And finding those, I think, is key. So closely related to values are worldviews. Worldviews describe how people think the world works and how people should relate to one another. And worldviews describe how people, they can act as filters that help people to determine whether or not climate change poses a serious risk to society and them. And here are a few examples. I already mentioned hierarchical and egalitarian. Another set would be individualism and communitarianism. And there are other worldviews, and very often they can go hand in hand with some like religious beliefs. But in the next slide, I'll show some examples that explain how worldviews work in the context of climate change. So people who are hierarchical or individualistic in their worldview tend to reject solutions that are regulation focused. But they do support solutions that allow people to act on their own and to be innovative and take risks and to benefit personally from solving problems. People who identify with as egalitarian are rather skeptical of solutions that come from the market, but tend to be supportive of solutions that involve regulation. So the takeaway here is to present the right solution to your audience, and all of these solutions are valid. Key is to identify and present the right solution to the right audience. So the solutions do not necessarily change. It's the way we frame them that would change. A third factor that comes into play in people's responses to climate change is their identities, or which groups do they affiliate with. So this identity determines their goals, and their goals matter. And these goals can be short-term self-interest versus longer-term benefits to society or the environment. And within each of us, if we just think about, like, we have multiple identities, and that doesn't mean we're schizophrenic, but multiple identities and multiple goals, and sometimes they can be in conflict. I may be the CEO of a business, but at the same time, I'm a parent, I'm a member of a board, a member of a religious community, a neighbor, a citizen, an employee, a shareholder, and you can add to the list. And those are important things that we can tie into. As a CEO, I may make my decision. I have financial goals for the company, but as a parent, I may have a different goal. And so if you know that the CEO is also a parent of three young children, you may start to relate to the parent's identity and build up on that in order to get them interested in kind of like a sustainable future rather than short-term quarterly results. So that's something to keep in mind of. People often adjust their behavior to match the behavior customary of a certain group. So because humans like to comply with social norms that govern groups they affiliate with, so it is important to showcase positive action that other people are taking to address climate change, especially when these people constitute a majority of a certain area or community. So communicators can help facilitate behavior change by highlighting norms surrounding climate-friendly behavior. One example would be, what are the Joneses doing? The Joneses actually are not driving that big SUV anymore. They got like a little electric car that they are recharging now. For the faith-based community, what was popular for a while was, what would Jesus drive? What would Jesus do? And logically, receiving social rewards or getting feedback and being appreciated or public feedback can actually spur social and climate-friendly behavior. So that's the reason why we look to others. That's why peer pressure works. We actually feel good if we belong to a group. Most of us do. And there are rewards from belonging to a group and complying with group norms that are worth more than money that I might have, that I might leave on the table. And we've done this in experiments. It is really interesting. Just a little token of like a group affiliation, being a member of the same group, being a member of the same state. We can tap into this when we're communicating messages about climate change and climate change action. And and that leads like to this question about how to find the right messenger for your audience. It is someone whose identities, values, and group affiliations are similar to those of your audience. Sending a punk to the Association of Farmers in Nebraska obviously wouldn't work. But an example that works very well, and I think many of you are familiar with Catherine Hayhoe, who the climate scientist at Texas A&M and an evangelical Christian, and who also is a member of the board of CCL. And I want to remind you of this fantastic monthly call that CCU webinar that she gave. So she is a great messenger for the groups that she's working with. And but also like being the right messenger that aligns in terms of values, worldviews, and group identity. Also consider the messengers behind the facts that you're presenting. So whom does your audience trust? Is it the Centers for Disease Control? Is it the Department of Energy? Is it NASA? Just doing your research on what are groups that they usually go to for information. So it's very important to think about those before you even go in front of a group. And one thing is like, if you are not the right messenger, or if you are new to a group, you could also enlist someone from within that group who will introduce you and generate a little bit of trust before you even go into this, into a meeting. So we can harness the power of groups. There is a lot of potential in working in groups. People look to groups for informal social norms, customs, and standards. And people exhibit different types of attitudes and behavior in groups than compared to when they are on their own in themselves, by themselves. And communicators can embed climate-friendly attitudes and activities into groups and provide information to leaders, even if those groups are not necessarily dealing with, or their agenda is not climate change. And one example of that is the Climate Conversation Project, which is organized by Minnesota Interfaith in Power. Interfaith Power and Light, which is with assistance from Climate Access. And the goal here is to lead people through guided group conversations about climate. And the success of this project really shows the potential of groups, especially those with strong morals and identities. Having people discuss climate change in groups is effective for a couple of reasons. One is that people are going to be able to bounce ideas off of people around them. And second, being in a group and being in a religious setting in this particular case can make a little more clear to people that climate change can be a moral issue and one that groups can help solve. It takes also out the this overwhelming feeling of like, well, I can't do anything about this alone. I'm like a drop in the bucket. And the group provides that kind of that very often that necessary strength. Just like the takeaway from the values, worldview, and identities discussion is, these are shaping how people seek information, how they absorb information, and how they take action, how they respond to climate change. So you can use those values and worldviews and identities as clues to help you shape your communication about climate change and to boost your efficacy as a communicator. Relating to another question that came in from the audience, how can I get to know my audience better? And one method to do that is participatory processes, and I will talk about those. So participatory processes, how can we assure that our communication falls on open ears and that it is followed up with action? There's a lot we can do actually in advance of any actual meeting, and these involve longer term ongoing processes. And we call this approach participatory processes. So determine in advance all relevant audiences and parties that should be at the table. And we also shouldn't be shy to include people who we will disagree with and who will disagree with us. So don't just pick the ones that are convenient to work with. So include partner organizations with different missions and goals. And it has to be a reciprocal relationship and mutual learning. As scientists, we have gone into countries where some of us thought like this country needs like clean water. And in our first meetings, we learned that clean water, yes, while it is important, is really not the most pressing issue. And in learning from the audience what information they need, it also generated new research questions, which is the beauty of these reciprocal relationships. And it's part of the research process. So you should, besides scientists and communicators and practitioners, include widely the general public. Once you know what research is of interest, findings are of interest to your audience, translate them into usable recommendations. Then the next thing is like distill. Nobody reads the 25-page research paper or 20 of those 25-page papers. It's really distilling and then evaluating. How did it go? How did the information resonate? Was there action? Was there follow-up? And then update and repeat. And that's why I said it's this long-term ongoing process. And why we want this, like, I want to communicate tomorrow and I want to be successful, we need to engage in this longer-term reciprocal process. And I think once you do that, it's really enjoyable because you're building relationships and you're building new communities. And the learning process is just wonderful. So what are some of the questions that you can ask before going into like, you have information about CCL, you have information about the carbon fee and dividend, you have information about sea level rise. So who can use this information? Who are the stakeholders who need to know this information? And which variables are of interest? Is it sea level rise, or is it drought, or is it heat waves, or is it extreme weather events that are of interest? What are suitable presentation formats? And then who should communicate the information? That's again a messenger question. Who do we need to liaise with? Who is missing from the table? Who has decision authority? I might be talking to a person who is super interested, but they have no authority to put anything in action or to implement any of the solutions that I'm proposing. And then who has decision resources, who has the capacity? And again, I think over and over asking, like, whom have we left out? And I think you can also ask, if you have partners, asking them, it's kind of like in a snowball effect, who else should be at the table? Who have you worked with? Who are your partners? And then I think obtaining additional information, it's like really like you can do your homework by, for instance, looking at polling results by demographic background, by party, by region. So if you're going in and talking to youth, look at polls that highlight climate change perceptions by youth. Party or affiliation or political orientation. I mean, that's such a big issue since we're a bipartisan organization. But also regionally, there are different perceptions of climate change based on region. So if you're talking to people in the Midwest, knowing where they stand maybe prepares you much better than if you're coming from New York and talking all about New York examples, and they might say, well, yeah, poor New York, you guys are going to be like, yeah. So one resource to look at for some of these pollings, the Climate Advocacy Lab distills them nicely for people like us. So I encourage you to sign up with them, and they have like weekly polls that they share with people where does the public stand. If you don't have time to do homework and you stand in front of a group, you're giving one of the presentations about CCL, ask questions at the beginning of the presentation. Get them to get an understanding of their level of knowledge, their potential misconceptions, so that you can actually clarify some of these important issues at the beginning. And in the communication guide, the 2014 guide, on page 8, there's actually a list of questions that you can draw from. But there's many more that you can ask to get a sense of your community. I can only highlight the importance of long-term relationships. They are, in most cases, the most successful. So while sometimes we have to communicate on the quick, fast, I wasn't prepared. We have tools for that, but building these long-term relationships will lead to much greater success. So there are additional benefits of these participatory processes. The early engagement of all relevant groups and the participation in problem identification and brainstorming of solutions leads to greater compliance with some of these solutions that are then being presented. But the participatory process in and of itself creates this social context, which then alters the way in which people acquire, learn, and engage with and act on new information. And this in turn activates social and environmental goals in people. So that's why the participatory processes have so many benefits on so many levels. And that's why I'm a big proponent of them. One of the questions that came to us was like to talk more about the loss aversion and and loss avoidance. I talked about this feeling of like the negative feelings of losing $100, that they outweigh the positive feelings associated with gaining the same amount of money, even though $100 should be $100, but losing them evokes a much stronger emotion than gaining and winning $100. So we are loss averse, and that's why people have a natural tendency to avoid losses rather than to seek gains. Now, let's project these losses and gains into the future. In studies that combined a loss-gain frame with a now versus future game, people discount future gains more than future losses. So people may be more likely to adopt environmentally friendly behavior and support costly emission reduction efforts if they believe their way of life is threatened and that inaction will result in greater losses. So while people do respond to future gains, potential future gains, they respond more strongly to future losses. And so they are less likely to adopt these measures if they focus on the current situation, which they see as acceptable, and then they discount the improvement of it. They say, oh, what do I care about the future? And so more concretely, when talking, for instance, to a homeowner, you can frame energy-efficient appliances or weatherization as helping the homeowner avoid losing money on higher energy bills in the future, instead of helping them save money in the future. While the net effect is the same, but avoiding higher energy bills will generate more attention and more likelihood of taking action. Let's look at a few more of these examples where future losses from inaction on climate actually have been highlighted. And one of them is the Stern report in 2006, and it's somewhat outdated now, but the price of inaction, according to Stern, would be extraordinary and the cost of action modest. He proposed to invest 1% of GDP per year to avoid 5% drop in GDP if we do nothing about climate change. But it's also something that we have seen in groups more recently. For instance, Citigroup issued a report in 2015, and it highlighted the cost of not acting on climate change as in the range of $44 trillion that would be lost in GDP by 2060. Similarly, the group called Risky Business around Bloomberg, Hank Paulson, and many others, according to them, there is a 1 in 20 chance that average annual losses from hurricanes and other coastal storms along the eastern seaboard and the Gulf of Mexico will grow by more than $42 billion due to sea level rise alone. Potential changes in hurricane activity could raise this figure to $108 billion. So here again, it's like this loss that that we will see if we don't act. As extreme heat, another example of climate change impacts, spreads across the middle of the country, by the end of the century, some states in the southeast, lower Great Plains, and Midwest risk up to 50 to 70% loss in average annual crop yields, corn, soy, cotton, and wheat, absent agricultural adaptation. So clearly making use of this loss frame. And so I think the economic losses that we have seen due to Hurricane Harvey, Irma, and Maria, and the wildfires, which all happened within 1 month, and we've seen could cost nearly like $300 billion in damage. And this was just like 1 month in 2017. So in the next decade, these economic losses and health costs, which are not even factored in there, are projected to reach even more. So these massive costs, while many people think they fall on like government and FEMA will bail us out and insurance, a lot of these costs will fall on individuals and families. And that is something to point out. It's not necessarily the government or the private sector. Well, they will be hit as well, but like it is the families and individuals who will have to deal with these losses. So I think there's a lot of power to highlighting the losses from inaction, and there are a lot of examples where people have and really powerful groups have, influential groups have adopted that approach.
But as a reminder, in the slide deck tonight, you will have links to both of these resources. Dr. Marks already did. We've had time for questions, so we'll have a chance to reboot after we actually formally close and we make people know that they can sign up if they need to. But here's where the content will be available come tomorrow. Dr. Marks has kindly provided her available email address. If you have any follow-up questions, here is mine as well for any feedback on Citizens Climate University overall. We are so grateful for your help and your participation in spreading this word about the importance of framing and being aware of the psychology behind how we communicate about climate change. The lesson tomorrow will be available on the homepage of the Learning Center under this recent trainings tab. Make sure to share it with your friends, your social media networks online, and any connections you might have that might be interested. And above and beyond all else, before we close, we wanted to make sure to thank you for being on the line tonight, for all of your ongoing efforts, for engaging in this spirit of critical inquiry, and we'll be happy to stick on the line for a little bit.